Is being a sports agent like Jerry Maguire?
As their agent, you know, you're taking care of their equipment deals. If you can't get them an equipment deal, you're purchasing their equipment for them. You're helping them find a trainer.
What kind of results are companies who sponsor sports venues looking for?
Typically, large corporations are probably looking for a 3-to-1 ratio, $3 to $4 for every $1 media spent.
Sports venue naming rights, what do they really cost?
It's very easy to get intoxicated by the sexiness of sports and all the glamour that comes along with it. And we want to make sure, number one, that our clients never lose sight that sport is only a tool to be used to affect to a positive degree what they're already trying to do.
Marketing sports in China when you have a Boston accent and don't speak Chinese.
There's 1.4 billion people there. So if you move the needle by 1%, that's very, very big.
This is the Language of Business. It's a podcast designed to inspire and inform entrepreneurs and anyone considering a startup. Our host is Greg Stoller, Harvard MBA and current senior lecturer at Boston University Questrom School of Business. Greg talks to a wide variety of people, learn what strategies work and which ones don't work. Here's Greg Stoller.
Thanks, Don. Athletes get the press and all of the big money, but it's the business minds behind the scenes that are often instrumental to their financial success. How can you help your team win off the field? Today we'll talk naming rights, corporate sponsorship, strategic planning, and taking your sports dreams all the way to China.
Professional athletes are fun to watch, and the best ones make millions. But who looks after the fine print of their contracts? Joe Rosen is the head of the baseball division of Orpheus Sports and represents professional ballplayers. Welcome to the Language of Business, Joe.
Hi, how are you, Greg?
How did you find your first client?
I was a lawyer at a big firm in Boston, Goulston & Storrs, and I made the decision that this is what I was going to do. I had developed the sports practice at Goulston for a number of years, wanted to do the player representation side, and approached the managing partner at Goulston about it, but it was really something that the fee structure didn't work in a big firm. So I went out on my own, and that was the big question. It was like, how am I going to find my first client? I got a call from a buddy of mine who I went to law school with. This was about a month after I had started doing this. I said, well, how do you do it? Do you just go up and say hi, and I'm Joe, and I'd like to represent you, and that's.
Would you offer to play catch with them?
And pretty much. They wouldn't want to play right. catch with me. So I did, and he said, yeah, that's really what you do. The first professional player who I represented was a player named Ryan Shaver. The player's mother called my friend and said, hey, I'd like you to represent my son, just out of the blue. And my friend said, you know, I can't really do this. He had been doing it for 10 years. This was a really young rookie ball player who had just signed out of junior college. And my friend called me and said, hey, I got a player for you if you want to represent him. And I said, absolutely, 100%. And I flew down to Arizona in July when it was about 140 degrees, and I signed him, and that was awesome.
What does it mean, though, sure. to represent a player? That doesn't necessarily mean the player is going to make it, but you are representing them, right?
If you're representing an amateur player, a high school player or a college player, that's what's called advising that player. And there's limits on what you can do. The NCAA limits what you can do, but the NCAA specifically allows high school and college players to have legal advisors, and you can help them and give them information about their draft prospects and things like that. So that's sort of the advising stage. So you're representing a player, but there can't be a written contract, so it's a very different thing. Representing a professional player, there's a lot of things that come into it. Helping them negotiate contracts in professional baseball, until you get to the major leagues, the contracts, you know, don't occur that often. You usually have one minor league contract, and hopefully you'll never have another minor league contract.
Sure, because they're going to make it to the big leagues, right?
Exactly. So there is obviously a lot of contract work, but there's other things that come into it. As their agent, I mean, that's what representing a player means. You know, you're taking care of their equipment deals. If you can't get them an equipment deal, you're taking care of their equipment. You're purchasing their equipment for them. You're helping them find a trainer. You know, I don't do financial advice or tax, but you know, I have relationships with people that I'll make introductions, or I'll help them make their selection of those people.
How many athletes do you feel comfortable representing?
I think my maximum for me personally would be between 30 and 35. I'm less than that right now. I like 25 to 30. That's always been the number that I feel comfortable with. You want a certain amount of guys in the big leagues, you want a certain amount of guys in the high levels of the minor leagues, and you want a certain number of draft guys and things like that.
Who have been some of your more notable players that you've represented?
Well, I represented Hideki Okajima when he was with the Red Sox for a number of years. I've worked with Brandon Moss. I've had 7 players in the big leagues in the 10 years that I've done this. So those are probably the two bigger names that that you've heard of. Eric Ferris, Ryan Reed is a client of mine. He's with the Mets now. He was with the Pirates in the big leagues last year. So I've had a number of guys up there. I've had first round picks. I've had top five round picks just about every year, except my first draft. It's been good. And now the recruiting side, it comes to me a little more than I have to go to them.
How do you get paid? Because we think of professional athletes as making millions,
right?
But when you first come onto the scene, they just have big dreams.
Right. There's a few places you get paid. When a player is drafted, if you are representing that player and that player signs with you, once they become a professional, you'll get a percentage of their signing bonus. A lot of times between when they draft and they sign until they get to the major leagues, that can be quite a long time. So you're working off that percentage of the signing bonus for sometimes forever. I mean, sometimes they never get to the big leagues, and sometimes it takes 5, 6, 7 years.
What would be an average signing bonus?
First rounders can make $1 million and up. After that, it goes down significantly. But if you're a fifth round pick, for example, you'll make between $250,000 and $350,000 or $400,000. Sometimes if you're a high school player, more, depending on that. But I mean, think about that. You're taking a percentage, a very small percentage. Most agents charge 4 to 5%.
Right.
You're taking a percentage of their signing bonus, and that's the last thing that you are seeing until that player gets to the big leagues.
If they get to the big leagues. From the business side, what are the more difficult terms that you have had to negotiate?
Whether it's a draft contract or a major league contract, the market is going to set the money. Obviously, as an agent, you're trying to get as much as possible for your client, but the market is really going to set that, especially in arbitration, right? I mean, you see some of these free agent contracts, players are getting paid maybe more than you think that they're worth, but that's the market. That's what it's setting. Arbitration, you're only negotiating with one team. The team doesn't have all the leverage, but it's set on market value based on players in similar situations in the past. You know, some of the other terms that come into play, especially for a player, you know, a Japanese player, they're looking for other things, you know, an interpreter, flights home, things like that. You have to be creative. You have to make sure, first and foremost, that the client is getting what he wants. And you think that money is the most important thing, but it isn't all the time.
Market forces notwithstanding, are the high salaries justified?
Absolutely, 100%. And I'll say this, once you get to the big leagues, the first 3 years, and this is, you know, generalization, your first 3 years, you're under the complete control of the team. They set your salaries. Your next 3 years, and they're super twos, right, if you're in the top percentage. Years 4, 5, and 6, you're in arbitration. And during arbitration, you have to sign with your team if they want you to, but they can't set the salary anymore. It's based on what similar players in similar circumstances have done. So only after 6 years are you a free agent? I mean, think about that. So if you get to the big leagues when you're 28 or 30 and you do well, you're not a free agent until you're 34 or you're 35.
Nobody's going to want you.
Right. You got to get as much as you can when you can. And this is the way the system is.
Thanks, Joe. Joe Rosen, the head of the baseball division of Orpheus Sports. Ever dream of getting paid to wear your favorite sports logo?
Coming up, a poor American kid moves from the housing projects to become a sports maven in China. But first, can sports truly impact business as well as athletes? Next on The Language of Business. Our sponsor is Art Lifting. Art Lifting helps small businesses and Fortune 500 companies uplift their offices while supporting their communities. Art Lifting's collection has over 1,300 original artworks in various styles and prices, available for purchase or rental rotation, plus custom-tailored and co-branded merchandise for corporate gifting and events. How does Art Lifting support communities? All of Art Lifting art is created by artists living with homelessness or disabilities from all across the USA. To learn more and view the collection, go to artlifting.com. Once again, here's Greg Stoller.
Thanks, Don. Do the fancy logos athletes wear really convince you to buy their products? Jafe says yes. He's a partner at the law firm of Nelson, Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough, and a chair of the sports business law practice. Jay, welcome to The Language of Business.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
So how did you come to specialize in sports business law?
Quite by accident. I was a corporate lawyer by training, and it came to be that one day a famous hockey player came in our office. He had a problem with a restaurant deal that had gone south. His name was Cam Neely. He was a superstar with the Boston Bruins at the time. I helped him out of that mess. And then
few
one
people
thing,
might know him
yes,
around these parts.
Yes,
right?
Currently the president of the Boston Bruins.
Of course.
And then he said, you know, why don't you go down there and negotiate my contract with Harry Sinden? So quite by accident, that's how I got started.
And besides Cam Neely, who are some of your other well-known clients?
Well, over the years, I've represented over 250 NHL players and some baseball players. Grant Fuhr was a Hall of Fame goalie, 5 Stanley Cups. Local players around here like Mike Greer, for example. And so it's been an enjoyable way to practice law in the sports world.
What's the breakdown between sponsorship versus transactional work?
Presently at Nelson Mullins, I chair the sports industry practice group. And a lot of my day is transactional-based law, and that's involving the representation of corporations, colleges and universities. It could be individual celebrities or athletes that have been approached by companies to be part of their marketing plans. A vast majority of my time is spent on that type of thing. I also represent a major corporation that does a lot of sports marketing in a global sense, so we're active with big properties such as the NFL and the PGA Tour.
When it comes to sponsorship, how is a company able to calculate its return on investment?
It's a good question. For years, it was throw a sign on a wall, hope people saw it, hope people bought your product. Now with technology, the metrics of measurement are tremendous. For example, they can run a sweepstakes, they can have surveys, all those metrics are counted. In addition, if there's a call to action by a celebrity endorser, they'll immediately cover and determine how many click-throughs to the company's website or product-specific targets were made by that potential customer for the product that the endorser is pushing. The metrics have gotten tremendously more sophisticated, and they spend their dollars much more wisely.
Is there a rule of thumb for what an acceptable return on investment is for one of those metrics?
In terms of revenue per dollar spent, typically large corporations are probably looking for a 3-to-1 ratio, $3 to $4 for every $1 of media spent. And you're spending media in a host of different ways.
And when you say $3 to $4, this is $3 to $4 of purchasing products associated with their name or click-throughs?
If there's a tie that they can make, for example, if a company is pushing a particular line of headphones through the National Football League, then they know how much money they're spending on those headphone marketing and marketing plans, and they can determine how much gross revenue was derived from those campaigns.
So if they're investing $1 million in terms of their advertising, they're hoping to generate $3 to $4 million of sales from that exposure?
At least, yes.
How about stadium naming rights?
Stadium naming rights are fascinating. They are far beyond putting your name up on the top of a large building. The stadium naming rights deal is the most complicated and complex deal because you're acquiring everything from the name of that bank or insurance company on the turnstile that you walk in the building, in club suites, on tickets, also exclusivity. For example, if it's a bank institution, exclusive ATMs, they'll have nowhere else to go. Or if their favorite credit card processor for a MasterCard or Visa, one of those cards is going to take priority. Those deals are extremely complex, but they're very valuable and quite costly.
Is the analysis for the return on investment similar to sponsorship?
Probably a little harder to quantify in terms of just consumer products versus because you're getting so many different media impressions, and you're also getting the ability to drive hospitality and B2B returns. So there's other ways of measuring your entertainment at those types of facilities. But they are well-regarded properties to get your hands on. And as a result, the owners of those properties are able to go much, much longer terms. MetLife Stadium, for example, I believe is a 17 or 20-year deal at $17 million a year.
What trends are you seeing in your industry practice?
Technology is a good example of something that I see all the time, and I think to some degree law is trying to catch up with technology. The companies want social media because it's a good, efficient way to get to consumers. The companies want to monitor the actions, the statements of their celebrities. You could have an unrelated tweet go out from a particular celebrity that may be relatively damaging to the brand. And that's another really important thing that I see all the time is when we go into these large sponsorships, whether it be with teams, leagues, or individuals, companies are concerned about protecting their brand. They say, Jay, if something goes wrong, we need to distance ourselves and do it promptly and efficiently and answer the questions later. So the brand is the single most important thing that they're after by way of protections.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Jay Fee, partner at the law firm of Nelson, Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough, and a chair of the Business Industry Sports Law Practice.
Still to come, what's it like speaking Chinese with a Boston accent? But first, can sports truly impact business as well as athletes? As the language of business continues.
How do you merge sports-specific goals with overarching business objectives? After stints with Nike, Pepsi, and J&J, Dave Minji is now honing his skills with his own company, GlideSlope. Joining us from New York, Dave, welcome to the Language of Business.
Hey, Greg, thanks for having me on.
What does the company's name, GlideSlope, mean?
Glide slope technically is an aeronautical term. It means the proper path an aircraft has to take to meet its landing point. And so a little bit of a metaphor, a theoretical kind of point of view on a sports industry is that we feel there's a lot of planes out there that are circling, if you will, and up flying high in the air who might not necessarily have the right approach to the proper business results they're searching for in the space of sport. So we tended to see ourselves as the handful of consultants, if you will, in the air traffic control tower. Now, so if you think about a glide slope, if you're above it, you overshoot the target. If you're below the proper path, obviously you're probably going to ditch into the dirt. And we want to make sure that our clients have the right approach and the right angle on attack for using the sports industry to affect their bottom line growth.
So what types of clients do you service?
You know, it's sort of an interesting offering for us at Glide Slope that we don't traditionally go after the large sports companies. Our main focus is those businesses whose core is not sport, what we tend to call the non-endemic. So if you think of large financial institutions, healthcare companies, automotive manufacturers, for us, it's not really about the Nikes and the Red Bulls of the world. It's more about those businesses whose core, as I said, is not sport, but increasingly are starting to turn to sport as a marketing tool to increase their bottom line.
What does a typical client engagement look like?
Our typical engagement might surprise you a bit, particularly because of where we start out. So for us, when we walk into a client, we're not immediately talking about the excitement of sport. We simply sit back and ask the client a series of questions first that lead us on a longer path to understand what's keeping them up at night. Because as we simply say at Glide Slope, there's no point in using sport, especially considering how expensive it can be around the world, if there's not a direct strategic approach on how it's going to help a company do what they're already trying to do. So again, keep in mind that we're with the non-endemics. So we want to know what a company's focused on. Is it greater retail penetration? Do they have an HR employee and retention problem? Perhaps around the world they might have some government relations issues or are working on some trade and tariff or trying to introduce new innovation for products in new markets. That's most important, and we believe it's very easy to get intoxicated by the sexiness of sport and all the glamour that comes along with it. And we want to make sure, number one, that our clients never lose sight that sport is only a tool to be used to affect to a positive degree what they're already trying to do. But then, most importantly, don't stop there. The key point at the end is to measure, and then, as we say, rinse and repeat and go back to the first step. So once you measure how effective sport has been, let's categorize that in a way that the executives who set up the alignment can digest whether this is truly working, and hopefully if it is, in what way can we increase to be even more successful moving forward.
You mentioned on your website that sports has the ability to impact lives and can be leveraged as a business driver.
Myself, I had the incredible opportunity to take a leave of absence from my time at Nike, and on behalf of the U.S. government, I moved to Iraq in 2004. Namely to help restart the Iraqi Olympic Committee. And I'll tell you an interesting story from there is that when we played the first Iraq football match and trying to get them re-qualified for the Athens 2004 Olympic Games, it was against Kuwait. And it was the first official meeting that those two nations had had in about 10 years, of course, given the conflicts of the regions. Dramatic incidents of that night dropped probably about in the 80% range. So what we could clearly see is that Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Turkmen, Christian, it didn't matter. They were all concerned that evening with how their national football team was once again taking the pitch and how they would be performing against their neighbor in Kuwait. And so when you think about the Final Four here in the United States, the way the Super Bowl captivates us once a year, sport has this unbelievable power to allow our passions and our sort of expressions of self, our identities, to come forth. And we think that if businesses can understand that and the social and emotional undercurrents that make that such a powerful thing, they can use that and leverage that to great business advantage. Simply focused on their business goals and understanding how sport can drive unique benefit if done well on a strategic platform.
Thanks, Dave. Dave Minji, president and founding partner of Glide Slope.
What's it like speaking Chinese with a Boston accent? Next on The Language of Business. If you enjoy listening to podcasts, and I'm guessing you do because you've gotten this far into this one, let me tell you about another one I think you'll enjoy. It's called The Secret to Her Success. If you want to get someone's attention, just tell them a great story. That's what The Story Behind Her Success with Candy O'Terry is all about. Once a week, she'll make your day and change your life by introducing you to a woman whose story is so powerful, you'll never forget it. The program host is award-winning broadcaster Candy O'Terry. She's been the Massachusetts Broadcaster Association Broadcaster of the Year and winner of 18 Gracie Allen Awards. Candy has interviewed over 800 women from every walk of life, so there's no stumbling around in this podcast. Success is so much more than the outcome. It's about the journey. It's a story of how you got there. So buckle up and go along for the ride.
The Story Behind Her Success with Candy O'Terry, available wherever you get podcasts. Once again, here's Greg Stoller.
Thanks, Don. A kid from Roxbury works his way out of the housing projects and gets into Boston College. From there, he becomes fascinated with sporting event management. Except not here, in China. The big question is, when he speaks Chinese, does he do so with a Boston accent? Tom McCarthy, welcome to The Language of Business.
Thank you very much, Greg. Pleasure to be here.
You've been in Asia since 1987. What caused you to go over?
Well, basically, I come out of the coaching business at the collegiate level and moved into a shoe business company called Etonic, which is very famous down in Brockton, and became the vice president of sourcing, and all these trips back and forth every month. Well, in 1987, right. Started visiting and moved in 1991, and bumped into a guy that got hired from the Denver Nuggets when Rupert Murdoch bought Star TV.
Sure.
What happened was they invited me to take your seat.
Right.
And I became the voice of the NBA for 3 years when they first hit Asia, the 53-country network. So from there, then I got invited to run basketball for Asia, which is now FIBA Asia. So
sure.
I looked over 44 countries and slowly but surely made my way towards the Middle Kingdom.
When did you transition from Hong Kong to mainland China?
I moved out of FIBA Asia, or the Asian Basketball Confederation, in 2000, end of 2001, and made the decision that China was actually bigger than Asia in terms of the development of sports. So I started a company, and we've had two or three companies along the way.
And what did the company do?
Our company now is a boutique sports event management and consultant company. Our main objective is to identify either growing sports, and for me, I like to be on the front end of things.
Sure.
At the same time, we had purchased all the rights for the China national tennis team.
Talk to us about your business model. Is it ticket sales? Is it commission deals?
We are primarily sponsorship driven because we don't own the facilities. Being a boutique company, we're not operating in the sphere like AEG. Or IMG,
sure.
That are the big gorillas in the industry. They have tons of cash, so they go out and they buy the stadium and this thing. What we do is we do deals with stadiums on the professional tournament. For the other things, it's more renting out facilities.
You're renting out the stadium, the difference becomes your profit.
And then to build the program, then we go out and identify title sponsor, presenting sponsor, official supplier, and go right down the list. And hopefully we accumulate enough money to pay the bills and then have a nice little net profit coming out of there.
How have you been able to do this successfully over so many years without being fluent in Chinese or Cantonese?
A good local partner. So I started a company with a lady, Lin Xiaowu, who is still with me today. So that would be the number one thing. And there is no business outside of China that has any success at all in China without a good local partner.
After 27 years, your biggest cultural problem you've encountered?
In China, there is a disease of, it's called the Nike effect. Put on my shoes and run at the first sign of danger, or at the first sign of a lot of profit can be grabbed. And this is a big danger. I'm owed more than I've made. I've had things like the Beijing Olympic Stadium. My rights, 10 years later, just ran out. Yet I never participated in those rights, because somebody on the side of the government sold them to David Stern and to AEG, to Tim Lewicki. So I had to decide, should I sue right before the Olympics and never do business again if I won, or turn the other way and go on and move on.
Other sports on your horizon?
We like to, number one, select a sport that is an Olympic sport, because in China, the Olympic sports get all the money from the government. And then second, you want to get into a sport that you think that there's upside. We got in on the front end of tennis just after they won the gold medal in Greece and right before the Jinjiangians jumped out and won Wimbledon and Australian Open, Wimbledon back to back. So right there, it gave a big jump start to tennis. And now people started to play. Everybody runs out and gives their kid a tennis rack. Oh yeah, you're going to be the next one. And so you have a rush. There's 1.4 billion people there. So if you move the needle by 1%, that's very, very big.
Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Tom McCarthy, president and CEO of the Beijing International Group, where he certainly knows how to think big.
Thanks, Greg. We post a new episode of The Language of Business every Tuesday. You can find us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, as they now call it, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, or just say Alexa, play the Language of Business podcast from MyCast.
Searching for latest episode of the Language of Business. Here it is from MyCast.
No matter how good your product is.
See, that was easy. If you could take a moment to subscribe and rate us, that would be great. Our director is Mark Mandel. Additional production by Derek Reisner. Social media by Jennifer Powell of ExcellentWriters.com. Consulting producer, Helen Tierney of Happy Accident Productions. Audio editing and voiceover by yours truly. Thanks also to Mike Carruthers of Perfect Your Podcast and SomethingYouShouldKnow.net. For Greg Stoller and the entire team, I'm executive producer Don Kelly. Thanks for listening to The Language of Business.